Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. We rely on the generosity of our listeners to sustain this ministry and the message of the coming kingdom of heaven. Please consider making a donation to Beth Emmanuel by clicking on the Donate tab at BethEmmanuel.org.
And John, calling two of his disciples to him, sent them to the master, saying, "Are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another?" And when the men had come to him, they said, "Yohanan the Immerser has sent us to you, saying, 'Are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another?'" And in that hour he healed many people of diseases and plagues and evil spirits. And on many who were blind he bestowed sight, and he answered them, "Go and tell Yohanan what you have seen and heard. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear, and the dead are raised, and the poor have the good news preached to them. And blessed is the one who is not offended by me." Luke 7:18-23. For the last several lessons, we have been discussing this text in light of the obscure Jewish expectation that God might redeem Israel through not just one Messiah, but actually two Messiahs: Messiah the son of Joseph, Mashiach ben Yosef, and Messiah the son of David, Mashiach ben David. And I suggested that in light of the idea of the potential of two Messiahs, it's possible that Yohanan might have been wondering, as he sat in prison awaiting his execution, he might have been wondering if indeed Yeshua of Nazareth was merely one of the two promised redeemers, and therefore poses the question, shall we look for another? And I've made the case for you that Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David represent the two dynasties of the two kingdoms of the Jewish people. Mashiach ben Yosef, that's Messiah, son of Joseph, representing the kingdom of Ephraim, Israel, the northern kingdom, and the household of Rachel. And Mashiach ben David, representing the kingdom of Judah, the household of Leah. And we saw how this happened when God made covenant promises of an heir and an eternal kingdom to both David over the tribe of Judah, but also to Jeroboam over the tribe of Ephraim, essentially promising two royal dynasties, two kingly lines, with two potential messiahs coming out of that. But we also saw how it's possible to forfeit one's spiritual destiny, so that Esau forfeited his spiritual destiny and his right as firstborn, so that it went to Jacob, along with his destined wife, Leah. And Reuben forfeited his position as firstborn over the household of Leah, and Simeon and Levi forfeited their positions in the line as well, leaving Judah to pick up those promises and become the heir of those blessings as firstborn over the house of Leah, even though he was fourth in birth order. And we also saw how Jeroboam himself forfeited the covenant promises that had been offered to him when he installed idols at Dan and Bethel and turned Israel to apostasy. In fact, I want to review that text from 1 Kings 12 right now. It says in verse 26, "And Jeroboam said in his heart, 'Now the kingdom will turn back to the house of David.'" This is his big fear, that the kingdom is going to revert to the house of David. So he says, "Now the kingdom will turn back to the house of David if this people goes up to offer sacrifices in the temple of the Lord at Jerusalem. Then the heart of this people will turn against their Lord, to Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they will kill me and return to Rehoboam, king of Judah." So the king took counsel and made two calves of gold. And he said to the people, "You have gone up to Jerusalem long enough. Behold your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." And he set one god in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. And this is how Jeroboam forfeited the opportunity. And this was how Jeroboam actually forfeited the promises that had been made to him through the prophet Ahijah. And we saw how subsequently the whole kingdom of Ephraim forfeited the opportunity to repent and fulfill their divine destiny, even in subsequent generations, until they were eventually taken away into captivity by Assyria. This tension between Judah and Joseph is a tension keenly felt in the Torah portion Miketz and the Torah portion Vayigash, which pits them against each other regarding Benjamin. In Vayigash, Judah confronts Joseph directly regarding Benjamin. And then finally, in Parshat Vayechi, when Jacob gives the blessings to his 12 sons, he passes the blessing of leadership and primacy to Judah, the firstborn over the house of Leah, whom he describes as a lion, but also upon Joseph he pours out the full extent of the blessings bestowed upon his fathers and nominates Ephraim to carry on the legacy of firstborn over his household. So the book of Genesis concludes with that tension between Joseph and Judah unresolved, while Benjamin, Joseph's younger brother, is stuck in the middle. And we are stuck in the middle with him. The fact that Beth Emmanuel is here and that you are here at Beth Emmanuel and that we as a community and a congregation are here 22 years after launch and still going is a miracle. 22 years ago on Shabbat Hanukkah, I said, "We have one flask of oil. Let's light it up and see how long it lasts." And the fire is still burning. Against the odds, and despite many forces that might have extinguished the flame along the way. So ordinarily, I like to take Shabbat Hanukkah as a sort of anniversary and give you a sort of a State of the Union address, a state of the community, and remind you about our mission here at Beth Emmanuel, and why this community and everything that we represent is so significant in the light of the coming redemption and the revelation that comes to us through the New Testament. It's something which we need to be reminded about from time to time because, well, it's just not obvious. To the outside observer, and even to the inside observer, this enterprise looks like an anomaly, an oddity, a curiosity of religious variety, but far removed from the center of concern of world religions. Messianic Judaism is already the red-headed stepchild of both the church and the synagogue. The synagogue looks at Messianic Judaism as an imposter from the church, Christians and apostates playing a Jewish game and Jewish dress-up. The church looks at Messianic Judaism as Judaizers and apostates who need to be censured. And that's why Messianic Judaism occupies this, what you could call, a religious no-man's land, stuck in the middle between these two major religions and under enormous pressure to renounce one and follow the other. Yet, despite that enormous pressure and the hazards of no-man's land, here we are, 22 years later, still holding our own, and I am stuck in the middle with you. Not only is the oil still burning, but we have become a lamp set in its stand that gives its light to the whole household, a city set on a hill. I like to think of Messianic Jews as the Benjamin character in the Parsha. Like Joseph, Benjamin is the son of Jacob and Rachel, but he's also been long estranged from his brother. It should be obvious to every disciple of Yeshua and every Messianic believer that the relationship in these Torah portions, described in these Torah portions, the relationship between Joseph and his brothers, aptly illustrates the relationship between Yeshua and the Jewish people at large, who recognize Yeshua neither as the Messiah nor even as a Jew. This implication of the story is so obvious that it's almost the Peshat level, almost the literal level reading of the text, at least for us. But among the brothers who do not recognize Joseph is the odd character of Benjamin. Benjamin is the silent, yet key player in the whole narrative. He's the younger son of Rachel. He was not part of the rejection of Joseph. He was not party to the deception of Jacob. He's the brother who did not sell Joseph to the Egyptians. At the time the unpleasant incident happened, he was just a child. In fact, Benjamin seems to vanish from the narrative and to be all but forgotten until he reemerges at the end of the story. So here's my premise. If the other 10 brothers represent Israel's rejection of Yeshua as the Messiah, then Benjamin must represent that portion of the Jewish people that did not reject Yeshua as the Messiah. In the narrative, Benjamin has a place among the brothers. He's one of the sons of Israel, but he has never abandoned allegiance to Joseph. So in this analogy that I'm making, Benjamin represents the Jewish believers. And you notice that Joseph hides his cup with Benjamin. You notice that Benjamin receives 5 times the portion from Joseph's table as his brothers. You notice that Benjamin carries the cup of the master and eats from the table of the master. Think of the story of the Apostle Paul, for example. In a vivid dramatization of the revelation of Yeshua to the Jewish people, Paul was literally blinded, and then his eyes were literally opened. His shock at the revelation of the Messiah's identity was no less than the shock of Joseph's brothers in Genesis 45 in Parshat Vayigash, when Joseph says, "I am Joseph." Coincidentally, Paul was from the tribe of Benjamin. Okay, but let's set all of that aside, and let's talk about Benjamin from a historical perspective. In the literal reading of biblical history, Benjamin is a small tribe of enormous consequence. Out of Benjamin came the first king of Israel, King Saul. The first messianic dynasty would have come out of Benjamin. The city of Jerusalem sits in the territory of Benjamin. The temple is in the territory of Benjamin. Benjamin's territory occupied an important strategic crossroads through the land of Israel, the main east-west route connecting Jericho to the Mediterranean, crossing the main north-south route connecting the Negev to Galilee and beyond all the way to Damascus. And for this reason, Benjamin was a battleground between the northern kingdom of Ephraim and the southern kingdom of Judah. They literally fought wars for the control of the tribal territory of Benjamin. The king of Judah would go out to fight the king of Israel, and the king of Israel would go out to fight the king of Judah for control of the territory of Benjamin. And Benjamin is stuck in the middle. My brother points out that the tribal territory of Benjamin is the stage on which most of the Bible plays out. The psalmist recognizes Benjamin's unique position as well. Psalm 68 creates a vision of a future day when God returns to his temple in Jerusalem in great pomp and pageantry. And surprisingly, the little tribe of Benjamin leads the procession to the temple. Our Torah portion sets up a contest between Judah and Joseph, and their competition is for Joseph's younger brother, Benjamin. In the story, it's clear that Judah has become the leader and the spokesman of the brothers. Parshat Miketz ends on a cliffhanger. The 11 brothers have not even left the city to return to Canaan when one of the viceroy's servants overtakes them and accuses them of stealing the viceroy's cup. Of course, they deny the allegation, but Benjamin, the youngest, is caught red-handed with the stolen silver cup. Unbeknownst to the brothers, Joseph has arranged to have the cup planted in Benjamin's sack. The Egyptians lead the 11 frightened brothers back to Joseph's palace. The men cast themselves upon the viceroy's mercy. As in Joseph's long-ago dreams, the 11 brothers prostrate themselves before him, thereby fulfilling his dream of the 11 sheaves bowing down before his sheaf. So Joseph demands of them, "What is this deed that you have done? Do you not know that such a person as I can indeed practice divination?" Judah speaks up on behalf of the others. He's acting as the spokesman. He says, "What can we say to my Lord? What can we speak? How can we justify ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Behold, we are my Lord's slaves, both we and the one whose possession the cup has been found." So he offers that they'll be all the brothers will be slaves to Joseph. But Joseph rejects Judah's offer. He only wants Benjamin to remain in custody. So this is the test. "The rest are free to go," he tells the brothers. "Far be it from me to do this. The man in whose possession the cup has been found, he shall be my slave. But as for you, go up in peace to your father." This was Joseph's test of hearts. He executed all these clever machinations only for this moment of testing. Joseph wants only to see if the brothers will opt to save their lives and abandon Benjamin as they had abandoned him. He wants to see whether or not they are willing to break their father's heart again. If they choose to return to Canaan, leaving Benjamin as a slave in Egypt, well, they go free. Then Joseph will know that they haven't changed. They really haven't changed. They have not repented. If, on the other hand, they refuse to abandon Benjamin and so refuse to bereave their father Jacob again, then Joseph will know that his brothers have grown and their hearts have changed and they have repented. And so the next Torah portion, Parshat Vayigash, begins with Judah's response to Joseph's test. Judah plucks up his courage and draws near. That's the Hebrew word, Vayigash, and he drew near to the viceroy to challenge him. The Midrash Rabbah asks, what does it mean that Judah drew near to Joseph? One answer is, he drew near to beg for mercy. Another answer says, he drew near to go to war for Benjamin. We have learned that the deeds of the fathers are portents for the sons. Judah represents the tribal confederation of the kingdom of Judah under the Davidic monarchy, also called the House of Judah. Joseph represents the tribal confederation of the kingdom of Israel under the kings of the north, also called the kingdom of Ephraim and the house of Joseph. Benjamin represents the beleaguered tribal territory of Benjamin, a strategic prize sandwiched between the kingdom of Judah and the kingdom of Israel. The Torah's narrative is showing us the kingdoms of Judah and Israel vying for control over Benjamin. The Midrash says, Vayigash, when Judah drew near, it was as a king going to war with another king. The brothers said, when kings are contesting with one another, what business is it of ours? It is proper for a king to argue with a king. And so that's why they let Judah do all the talking. So according to this interpretation from the Midrash Rabbah, Judah symbolizes the Davidic monarchy and Joseph symbolizes the monarchy of the house of King Jeroboam, the first king of the northern kingdom. The sages extended this concept to apply to the ultimate king, King Messiah. Just as the nation divided into two kingdoms ruled by a dynasty from Judah and a dynasty from Joseph, they could anticipate two distinct messiahs, a Davidic Messiah from the tribe of Judah and an Ephraimite Messiah from the house of Joseph. And so Jewish tradition teaches that the Messiah, son of David, will fulfill the prophecies of Messiah's rule and reign, and the Messiah, son of Joseph, will fulfill the prophecies that seem to predict a suffering Messiah, a man of sorrows, and a man of war. In view of these interpretations, our Torah portion hints toward that ultimate redemption when the spiritual force of the Messianic Son of Judah draws near to the spiritual force of the Messianic Son of Joseph. The Midrash Rabbah says, Judah did not cease from answering Joseph word for word until he penetrated to his very heart. and Hasidic teaching comes and explains that Judah drew near, Vayigash, to Joseph to symbolize a reconciliation of the spirit of Judah and the spirit of Joseph. And that's exactly what we see in Yeshua of Nazareth, a reconciliation of these two prophetic destinies, Messiah, son of Joseph, Messiah, son of David. Because remember, it's possible to forfeit. And Jeroboam forfeited. And the kings of Ephraim forfeited. And the kingdom of Israel forfeited. And so Yeshua of Nazareth picks it up. The Haftarah portion for Vayigash is Ezekiel 37:15-28, and it echoes the same theme with a picture of the final redemption, which depicts the house of Judah and the house of Joseph as two sticks combined into one, where the Lord says to Ezekiel, "Son of man, take a stick and write on it for Judah and the people of Israel associated with him. Then take another stick and write on it for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and all the house of Israel associated with him, and join them one stick into one stick, that they may become one in your hand. Behold, I am about to take the stick of Joseph, that is, in the hand of Ephraim, and the tribes of Israel that are associated with him, and I will join with it the stick of Judah, and make them one stick, that they may become one in my hand. When the sticks on which you write are in your hand before their eyes, then say to the people, thus says the Lord God, behold, I will take the people of Israel from the nations among which they have gone, and will gather them from all around and bring them to their own land. And I will make them one nation, no longer two, but one nation in the land on the mountains of Israel. And one king shall be king over them all. No longer two kingdoms. They shall no longer be two nations, no longer divided into two kingdoms. They shall not defile themselves anymore with their idols and their detestable things and their transgressions, but I will save them from their backslidings in which they have sinned, and will cleanse them, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God, and my servant David shall be king over them. Mashiach ben David. And they shall have one shepherd, and they shall walk in my rules, and be careful to obey my statutes. And they shall dwell in the land that I gave to my servant Jacob, where your fathers lived. They and their children and their children's children shall dwell there forever. And David, my servant, shall be their prince forever." So now we see this reconciliation is no longer two. We're no longer talking about two kingdoms. We're no longer talking about two dynasties, and therefore, we're no longer talking about two messiahs. "I will make a covenant of peace with them. It shall be an everlasting covenant with them. I will set them in their land and multiply them, and will set my sanctuary in their midst forever. And my dwelling place shall be among them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And then the nations will know that I am the Lord, who sanctifies Israel, when my sanctuary is in their midst forevermore." In other words, the triumphant conquering Messiah, son of David, becomes one with the suffering Messiah, son of Joseph, as one shepherd from the house of David, Yeshua of Nazareth. That's the Haftarah portion for Vayigash, the same parsha in which Joseph reveals his identity to his brothers, declaring, "I am Joseph, your brother." A moment that corresponds to the revelation of Yeshua of Nazareth as the Messiah to the Jewish people and ultimately to the whole world. Jeroboam and the house of Joseph, the 10 northern tribes, forfeited their prophetic destiny and messianic potential, so that in the prophecy, Jeroboam's worst fear comes true. Now the kingdom will return back to the house of David. Likewise, the kingship returns to the house of David. Therefore, the potential, the messianic potential of Mashiach ben Yosef, who must die on behalf of the nation, is also returned to the house of David. But how is this possible? How can one Messiah fulfill both roles, both as the Messiah who suffers and dies on behalf of the nation, and also as the Messiah son of David who rules on the throne of his father David? The two sticks are made one in God's hand. The two roles are made one in Yeshua, who suffers, dies, yet rises from the dead, and returns to rule over a united kingdom, ultimately reconciling Rachel and Leah, and even if it were possible, reconciling Jacob and Esau, reconciling all these sibling rivalries, and all things into one, as it says in Colossians, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. And this is the answer that we offer to Yochanan the Immerser when he asks, "Are you the one who is to come, or should we expect another?" Yeshua of Nazareth is the one who was to come, and the one who is yet to come. And this answer puts us in the middle, like the little tribe of Benjamin, as contested territory between Judaism and Christianity, unable to sever ourselves from either one, or to abandon ourselves completely to one or the other. All because of this conviction about Yeshua of Nazareth, risen from the dead. And that leaves us where? It leaves us stuck in the middle with you. Take on my yoke and learn from me and find rest for your soul.